Chapter 3. The Revelation. I can now turn with some relief to a more impersonal view of this great subject. Allusion has been made to a body of fresh doctrine. Whence does this come? It comes in the main through automatic writing, where the hand of the human medium is controlled, either by an alleged dead human being, as in the case of Miss Julia Ames, or by an alleged higher teacher, as in that of Mr. Stainton Moses. These written communications are supplemented by a vast number of transutterances, and by the verbal messages of spirits, given through the lips of mediums. Sometimes it has even come by direct voices, as in the numerous cases detailed by Admiral Osborne Moore in his book The Voices. Occasionally it has come through the family circle and table tilting, as, for example, in the two cases I have previously detailed within my own experience. Sometimes, as in a case recorded by Mrs. De Morgan, it has come through the hand of a child. Now, of course, we are at once confronted with the obvious objection: how do we know that these messages are really from beyond? How do we know that the medium is not consciously writing, or if that be improbable, that he or she is unconsciously writing them by his or her own higher self? This is a perfectly just criticism, and it is one which we must rigorously apply in every case, since if the whole world is to become full of minor prophets, each of them stating their own views of the religious state with no proof save their own assertion, we should, indeed, be back in the dark ages of implicit faith. The answer must be that we require signs which we can test, before we accept assertions which we cannot test. In old days they demanded a sign from a prophet, and it was a perfectly reasonable request, and still holds good. If a person comes to me with an account of life in some further world, and has no credentials save his own assertion, I would rather have it in my waste paper basket than on my study table. Life is too short to weigh the merits of such productions. But if, as in the case of Stainton Moses, with his spirit teachings, the doctrines which are said to come from beyond are accompanied with a great number of abnormal gifts, and Stainton Moses was one of the greatest mediums in all ways that England has ever produced, then I look upon the matter in a more serious light. Again, if Miss Julia Ames can tell Mr. Stead things in her own earth life, of which he could not have cognizance, and if those things are shown, when tested, to be true, then one is more inclined to think that those things which cannot be tested are true also. Or once again, if Raymond can tell us of a photograph, no copy of which had reached England, and which proved to be exactly as he described it, and if he can give us, through the lips of strangers, all sorts of details of his home life, which his own relatives had to verify, before they found them to be true, is it unreasonable to suppose that he is fairly accurate in his description of his own experiences and state of life at the very moment at which he is communicating? Or when Mr. Arthur Hill receives messages from folk of whom he never heard, and afterwards verifies that they are true in every detail, is it not a fair inference that they are speaking truths also, when they give any light upon their present condition? The cases are manifold, and I mention only a few of them, but my point is that the whole of this system, from the lowest physical phenomenon of a table wrap-up to the most inspired utterance of a prophet, is one complete whole, each attached to the next one, and that when the humbler end of that chain was placed in the hand of humanity, it was in order that they might, by diligence and reason, feel their way up it until they reached the revelation which waited in the end. Do not sneer at the humble beginnings, the heaving table or the flying tambourine, however much such phenomena may have been abused or simulated, but remember that a falling apple taught us gravity, a boiling kettle brought us the steam engine, and the twitching leg of a frog opened up the train of thought and experiment which gave us electricity. So the lowly manifestations of Hydesville have ripened into results which have engaged the finest group of intellects in this country during the last 20 years, and which are destined, in my opinion, to bring about far the greatest development of human experience which the world has ever seen. It has been asserted by men for whose opinion I have a deep regard, notably by Sir William Barrett, that psychical research is quite distinct from religion. Certainly it is so, in the sense that a man might be a very good psychical researcher, but a very bad man. But the results of psychical research, the deductions which we may draw, and the lessons we may learn, teach us of the continued life of the soul, of the nature of that life, and of how it is influenced by our conduct here. If this is distinct from religion, I must confess that I do not understand the distinction. To me it is religion, the very essence of it. But that does not mean that it will necessarily crystallize into a new religion. Personally, I trust that it will not do so. Surely we are disunited enough already? Rather would I see it the great unifying force, the one provable thing connected with every religion, Christian or non-Christian, forming the common solid basis upon which each raises, if it must needs raise, that separate system which appeals to the varied types of mind. The southern races will always demand what is less austere than the north, the west will always be more critical than the east. One cannot shape all to a level conformity. But if the broad premises which are guaranteed by this teaching from beyond are accepted, then the human race has made a great stride towards religious peace and unity. The question which faces us, then, is how will this influence bear upon the older organized religions and philosophies which have influenced the actions of men? The answer is, that to only one of these religions or philosophies is this new revelation absolutely fatal. That is to materialism. I do not say this in any spirit of hostility to materialists, who, so far as they are an organized body, are, I think, as earnest and moral as any other class. But the fact is manifest that if spirit can live without matter, then the foundation of materialism is gone, and the whole scheme of thought crashes to the ground. As to other creeds, it must be admitted that an acceptance of the teaching brought to us from beyond would deeply modify conventional Christianity. But these modifications would be rather in the direction of explanation and development than of contradiction. It would set right grave misunderstandings which have always offended the reason of every thoughtful man, but it would also confirm and make absolutely certain the fact of life after death, the base of all religion. It would confirm the unhappy results of sin, though it would show that those results are never absolutely permanent. It would confirm the existence of higher beings, whom we have called angels, and of an ever-ascending hierarchy above us, in which the Christ Spirit finds its place, culminating in heights of the infinite with which we associate the idea of all power or of God. It would confirm the idea of heaven, and of a temporary penal state which corresponds to purgatory, rather than to hell. Thus this new revelation, on some of the most vital points, is not destructive of the beliefs, and it should be hailed by really earnest men of all creeds as a most powerful ally, rather than a dangerous devil-begotten enemy. On the other hand, let us turn to the points in which Christianity must be modified by this new revelation. First of all, I would say this, which must be obvious to many, however much they deplore it. Christianity must change or must perish. That is the law of life, that things must adapt themselves or perish. Christianity has deferred the change very long, as he has deferred it until her churches are half empty, until women are her chief supporters, and until both the learned part of the community on one side, and the poorest class on the other, both in town and country, are largely alienated from her. Let us try and trace the reason for this. It is apparent in all sects, and comes, therefore, from some deep common cause. People are alienated, because they frankly do not believe the facts as presented to them to be true. Their reason and their sense of justice are equally offended. One can see no justice in a vicarious sacrifice, nor in the God who could be placated by such means. Above all, many cannot understand such expressions as the redemption from sin, cleansed by the blood of the Lamb, and so forth. So long as there was any question of the fall of man, there was at least some sort of explanation of such phrases. But when it became certain that man had never fallen, when with ever fuller knowledge we could trace our ancestral course down through the caveman and the drift man, back to that shadowy and far-off time, when the man-like ape slowly evolved into the ape-like man, looking back on all this vast succession of life, we knew that it had always been rising from step to step. Never was there any evidence of a fall. But if there were no fall, then what became of the atonement, of the redemption, of original sin, of a large part of Christian mystical philosophy? Even if it were as reasonable in itself as it is actually unreasonable, it would still be quite divorced from the facts. Again, too much seemed to be made of Christ's death. It is no uncommon thing to die for an idea. Every religion has equally had its martyrs. Men die continually for their convictions. Thousands of our lads are doing it at this instant in France. Therefore the death of Christ, beautiful as it is in the gospel narrative, has seemed to assume an undue importance, as though it were an isolated phenomenon for a man to die in pursuit of a reform. In my opinion, far too much stress has been laid upon Christ's death, and far too little upon his life. That was where the true grandeur and the true lesson lay. It was a life which even in those limited records shows us no trait which is not beautiful, a life full of easy tolerance for others, of kindly charity, of broad-minded moderation, of gentle courage, always progressive and open to new ideas, and yet never bitter to those ideas which he was really supplanting, though he did occasionally lose his temper with their more bigoted and narrow supporters. Especially one loves his readiness to get at the spirit of religion, sweeping aside the texts and the forms. Never had anyone such a robust common sense, or such a sympathy for weakness. It was this most wonderful and uncommon life, and not his death, which is the true center of the Christian religion. Now, let us look at the light which we get from the spirit guides upon this question of Christianity. Opinion is not absolutely uniform yonder, any more than it is here. But reading a number of messages upon this subject, they amount to this. There are many higher spirits with our departed. They vary in degree. Call them gels, and you are in touch with old religious thought. High above all these is the greatest spirit of whom they have cognizance, not God, since God is so infinite that he is not within their ken, but one who is nearer God, and to that extent represents God. This is the Christ spirit. His special care is the earth. He came down upon it at a time of great earthly depravity, a time when the world was almost as wicked as it is now, in order to give the people the lesson of an ideal life. Then he returned to his own high station, having left an example which is still occasionally followed. That is the story of Christ as spirits have described it. There is nothing here of atonement or redemption. But there is a perfectly feasible and reasonable scheme, which I, for one, could readily believe. If such a view of Christianity were generally accepted, and if it were enforced by assurance and demonstration from the new revelation which is coming to us from the other side, then we should have a creed which might unite the churches, which might be reconciled to science, which might defy all attacks, and which might carry the Christian faith on for an indefinite period. Reason and faith would at last be reconciled, a nightmare would be lifted from our minds, and spiritual peace would prevail. I do not see such results coming as a sudden conquest or a violent revolution. Rather will it come as a peaceful penetration, as some crude ideas, such as the eternal hell idea, have already gently faded away within our own lifetime. It is, however, when the human soul is plowed and harrowed by suffering, that the seeds of truth may be planted, and so some future spiritual harvest will surely rise from the days in which we live. When I read the New Testament with the knowledge which I have of spiritualism, I am left with a deep conviction that the teaching of Christ was in many most important respects lost by the early church, and has not come down to us. All these allusions to a conquest over death have, as it seems to me, little meaning in the present Christian philosophy, whereas for those who have seen, however dimly, through the veil, and touched, however slightly, the outstretched hands beyond, death has indeed been conquered. When we read so many references to the phenomena with which we are familiar, the levitations, the tongues of fire, the rushing wind, the spiritual gifts, the working of wonders, we feel that the central fact of all, the continuity of life and the communication with the dead, was most certainly known. Our attention is arrested by such a saying as, "Here he worked, no wonders because the people were wanting in faith." Is this not absolutely in accordance with psychic law as we know it? or when Christ, on being touched by the sick woman, said, "Who has touched me? Much virtue has passed out of me." Could he say more clearly what a healing medium would say now, save that he would use the word "or" instead of "virtue"? Or when we read, "Try the spirits, whether they be of God," is it not the very advice which would now be given to a novice approaching a seance? It is too large a question for me to do more than indicate, but I believe that this subject, which the more rigid Christian churches now attack so bitterly, is really the central teaching of Christianity itself. To those who would read more upon this line of thought, I strongly recommend Dr. Abraham Wallace's Jesus of Nazareth, if this valuable little work is not out of print. He demonstrates in it most convincingly that Christ's miracles were all within the powers of psychic law as we now understand it, and were on the exact lines of such law even in small details. Two examples have already been given. Many are worked out in that pamphlet. One which convinced me as a truth was the thesis that the story of the materialization of the two prophets upon the mountain was extraordinarily accurate when judged by psychic law. There is the fact that Peter, James and John, who formed the psychic circle when the dead was restored to life, and were presumably the most helpful of the group, were taken. Then there is the choice of the high pure air of the mountain, the drowsiness of the attendant mediums, the transfiguring, the shining robes, the cloud, the words, "Let us make three tabernacles," with its alternate reading, "Let us make three booths or cabinets," the ideal way of condensing power and producing materializations. All these make a very consistent theory of the nature of the proceedings. For the rest, the list of gifts which St. Paul gives as being necessary for the Christian disciple is simply the list of gifts of a very powerful medium, including prophecy, healing, causing miracles or physical phenomena, clairvoyance, and other powers. I Corinth, Zia 8:11. The early Christian church was saturated with spiritualism, and they seem to have paid no attention to those Old Testament prohibitions which were meant to keep these powers only for the use and profit of the priesthood. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.